Good evening. Can I first welcome you all to the launch of Social Advantage and Disadvantage on behalf of the Department. I'm David Pearshow, your chair and timekeeper, and I'm hoping you'll have a very interesting evening and intense discussion. If things get too hot and the fire alarms go off, then you have two choices. Well, you have three, actually. You could stay, but I don't... you leave by one of these doors and gather in Lincoln's Inn Field, and there you could join some of the most disadvantaged in London, who gain a rather small advantage at 11 p.m. when hot soup is served. Now, who's here? We've got the two editors of the book, Hartley Dean and Lucinda Platt, and Sonia Exley from the department, and on the far end, Fran Bennett from Oxford University, who will be discussant. In the front row are all the authors of the chapters of the book, or not quite all, who slightly remind me of the dogs in Animal Farm, who growled ferociously if anyone dissented from what was said on the platform. In Animal Farm, the dogs face the other animals, and here the authors are looking forward. So they're quite fairly harmless, I hope. It would be very good to hear each of them speak for 15 minutes or so, but that would take nearly 5 hours. So Hartley and Lucinda will introduce the book, and Sonia's going to reflect on its implications for policy. And then Fran Bennett will discuss the entire book, having, she assures me, read every word of it. Then three of the authors will reply, then we'll have half an hour for questions, comments and discussion, and then there's a reception where you can discuss further. Buy the book and get it signed by one or more authors. And if you get all of them to sign, maybe in 100 years it'll be worth more than a Leicester City shirt. The preface to the book starts, "This volume represents in part a replacement for the highly successful Understanding Social Exclusion, which was edited by John Hills, Julian Legrand and me. In the decades since, the concept of social exclusion has slipped down the social policy agenda." End quote. That fact, that it slipped down the agenda, must call into question whether it was highly successful. But the book launched today does much more than was attempted then. For a start, you get 4 more chapters and 100 more pages. More importantly, it's got chapters on human rights, wealth, ageing, gender, ethnicity, migration, religion and crime, which got scant or no attention in the earlier book. Rather shows it up. I'm going to let the editors describe the book's contribution and the framework of advantage and disadvantage, but the relevance and the topicality of the subject was recognised 6 hours ago by Her Majesty the Queen when she said at the opening of Parliament, "New legislation will be introduced to tackle some of the deepest social problems in society and improve life chances. To tackle poverty and the causes of deprivation, including family instability, addiction and debt, my government will introduce new indicators for measuring life chances." Unfortunately, no one told her that it takes more than new indicators to tackle poverty and the causes of deprivation, but it was nice to know that she's concerned about it. We're certainly going to hear much more about advantage in the next few weeks. Advantage Williams, advantage Djokovic, advantage Nadal. A big advantage to the singles, whoever wins the singles championship, whether a lady or gentleman, who take home £2 million for winning 6 matches. One player, Stan Wawrinka, has a quotation from Beckett's Waiting for Godot tattooed on his left forearm, which is, I think, quite relevant and important. The words he has tattooed are, "Ever tried, ever failed, no matter. Try again, fail again, fail better." In some ways, they may stand as an epitaph for those writing about social inequality, social exclusion, or now social disadvantage. In another way, the lingering hope the dream that never dies of a more equal society that is fundamental to reducing disadvantage in many spheres that is analysed in this book is rather like Godot. Godot never arrives. It is little help saying that we would prefer not to start from where we are. Does that mean that all the academic efforts are in vain? You must decide, but I think not, at least on good days. As Polly Vizard put it in her chapter on human rights, the incremental elimination of injustices can and should proceed in advance of the specification of a full theory of perfect substantive equality. So we have to start from where we are, and I must stop right now. And our first speaker is Hartley Dean on the background and contribution of the book. Hartley.
Okay, the background to the book. David has already sort of mentioned the fact that this is very much intended as a successor to Understanding Social Exclusion, published back in 2002, which was certainly a very important output from CASE, the Centre for the Analysis of Social Exclusion here at the LSE. There was fairly protracted discussion at one stage as to whether there should perhaps be a second edition of that book, because it was an important book. But then there was the feeling that that might not be entirely appropriate, and whether indeed it would be possible to have a satisfactory successor. And as David has already alluded to, the issue here was the way in which the term, at least, social exclusion, seemed to have slipped off the policy-making agenda somewhat. And part of the problem here is that, and what we reflected on, was the extent to which we had to address the way in which competing concepts elide each other as they move up and down the policy-making agenda. And I recall this observation by community activists just before I came to the LSE in around 2002. She was an activist on the Marsh Farm Estate, which is what is widely regarded as a deprived neighbourhood in Luton. And she said, well, look, in the old days, they, by which you're referring to the politicians and the experts, they used to tell us that the problems of our community were all to do with us being poor. Well, then they started to tell us it wasn't because we're poor, but socially excluded. But now they're telling us it's because we haven't got enough social capital, whatever that means. And there is this sense in which there is a certain amount of fickle fashion around the evolving conceptual agenda. This was especially so, I think, during the 1980s and 1990s. We witnessed, in many ways, the displacement of discussions using the language of poverty in favour of the language of social exclusion. Poverty is now, we can talk about the P word again, it seems to be back on the agenda. Social exclusion has perhaps fallen from view. But there's also, in recent years, been a really important the emergence of some really important new sort of concepts discussed, particularly at the international level, not simply in the UK and Europe, where we had been much concerned with the difference between poverty and social exclusion and the relationship between the two. Preoccupations with concepts like the capabilities, the concept of social capital, social mobility, very much a current preoccupation amongst policymakers, certainly in the UK. Now, the question is, to what extent does the notion of social advantage and disadvantage, social disadvantage, transcend that sort of process of fickle fashion? There is a sense in which concepts of advantage and disadvantage are generic. They don't seem to actually have a very fixed definition. Are they to be regarded as simply umbrella terms encompassing the issues to do with poverty, exclusion, class, gender, race, and so on and so forth? But they could perhaps be more than simply umbrella terms that allow us to include them all within the compass of a single book. What we can see is that there is the potential for some theoretical significance here, because what thinking about disadvantage does is to acknowledge the constitutive significance of relative advantage. It is focusing on social relations and processes, so that, for example, we are indeed talking about privilege as well as deprivation, wealth as well as poverty, inclusion as well as exclusion, power as well as powerlessness. So that was the sense that we carried when we started to assemble this particular book. I will just very quickly outline the contents of the book. As David has already indicated, several of the contributing authors are already here. They all have current or past connections with the LSE, so this is very much an LSE output. And the first part, there are three substantive parts to the book. The first part is very much concerned with concepts and theory. So there is a chapter by myself on poverty and social exclusion, the ancient and contested concept on the one hand, the usurper concept, if you like, social exclusion, but also a discussion of the recurrent debate about underclass, one of the manifestations of the social exclusion concept being one that morphs into corrosive concepts of underclass and the debate that are associated with that. Secondly, we have a chapter by Tanya and Rod Hick. Rod is with us, back from Cardiff to join in these proceedings today. Focusing on the capability approach, very influential conceptual debate instituted by Amartya Sen. Chapter 3 by Polly, who isn't here today, unfortunately, but David has already quoted her, around the human rights and equalities agenda. The whole notion that disadvantage can be associated with exclusion from denial of rights, whether they be formal rights, equality in that sense, or substantive rights to well-being. And then a chapter by Lucinda on class, competing concepts of class, notions of economic, social, and cultural capital, and the current preoccupations of policymakers with the concept of social mobility. The second part of the book is concerned with advantage and disadvantage across the life course, focusing on processes and everyday lives, experiences of growing up in families, by Kitty, who's with us today. Chapter on education and learning, experiences at school, by Sonia, who will be talking to us in a moment. Chapter on income distribution and another on the role of wealth, Stephen Jenkins and John Hills. And is Jack coming? Yeah.
No, not yet.
No, okay. I include a chapter on divisions of labour and work, so experiences in the labour market. And there's a chapter by Emily Grundy looking at the social consequences of chronological aging, the social consequences to do with processes of aging across the life course. Then the third substantive part is looking at various cross-cutting, intersecting themes that run through what have been discussed around the concepts of advantage and disadvantage. A chapter on gender by Margarita Leon, chapter on race and ethnicity by Coretta with Lucinda. Coretta is with us. Chapter by Isabel Schutz, looking at citizenship and migration. Chapter on religion by Mark and Torrey, also with us. Chapter on social disadvantage and place by Neil Lee from our geography department here, which is an interesting department. Neil is there. He should be down at the front there so we can see. Hello, Neil. And finally, a chapter on crime and punishment by Tim Newburn, who unfortunately couldn't be here today. So that is very much the outline of the substantive contents of the book. But there is a part four, which includes a conclusion. This is the point at which I shut up, and Lucinda takes over and talks about the way in which we think about using social advantage and disadvantage as indeed a framework for critical analysis. Do you want me to just click the next? Should I just click your neckline?
What, and leave me here?
No, it's up to you. No, that's fine.
No, you come at all.
Yeah, I'll stand up. I prefer to stand up.
Right,
you can hit my face. The slides aren't very informative, so they don't matter. But so as Hartley's shown you kind of the breadth and the coverage of the book as a whole and where we started from. So I'm leaping to the end, and what we're trying to do here was to show how actually there may be a lot of diversity across the book, a lot of looking across these multiple domains, multiple areas of life, but how this concept of social advantage and disadvantage actually gave quite a useful framework for the future, for critical analysis, for thinking more broadly, and that perhaps goes beyond some of these other concepts like social exclusion, like poverty. And I'm going to say why I think that is. So I think, first of all, there's the issues of distributions and groups that social advantage and disadvantage bring attention to. So in terms of distribution, social advantage and disadvantage draw attention to the poles of experience, both how those best off manage to preserve their position and how those with least resources are marginalised. So we can think about the top and the bottom, but we can also think across the distribution. And this draws attention to the importance of relative position. So whether that's relative position in income and wealth, or education or occupation or other domains of life. So such relative position is not just the exclusion of the worst off relative to the rest, but you think of the relative disadvantage of the middle relative to the top, or the relative advantage of the middle relative to the bottom. And this matters, and this is way of looking across society and how people relate to each other is important. And relative positions also operate across groups, as we see. So people judge themselves also relative to others who they see to be different, ascribe group status to. So social advantage, so we can think also of social advantage groups, socially advantaged and disadvantaged groups, as well as social advantage and disadvantage across the distribution. And we can see that this perspective looks at how positions are maintained by access to resources, and also groups are defined by their relative, often by their relative powerlessness, by their disadvantage. Often as minorities, using minorities in a very broad sense, gain success, they cease to be minorities or cease to be recognised as such. A small example, which Isabel talks about partly in her chapter, is how immigrants, as well as being among the most disadvantaged in our societies, are often among the most advantaged, the most wealthy, the most powerful, but they are often not visible in the same way. They're not silent, they're not measured, they're not counted, they're not seen in the same perspective. And, of course, the norm against which we often measure is not further defined. So there's the distribution and there's groups, but also, I think, a focus on the multidimensional aspects of disadvantage and advantage can draw attention to inequalities within as well as across groups. So it can bring together those two, the group and the distributional issue. And I think this recognition of diversity within groups, groups such as women, within groups such as older people, within groups such as minorities, is important. I think it has three analytical payoffs. First of all, it can demonstrate how the advantage of one group or the advantage of those in one relatively disadvantaged group may build their advantage on or their claims to equality through the disadvantage of others. To be more specific, we can think, for example, about how advantaged women often obtain their equality in the labour market with men through using, for example, migrant labour or the labour of more disadvantaged women in order to maintain that competition. The second analytical payoff, I think, is that looking at diversity within groups challenges the very notion of groupness. We tend to ascribe, I think, too much homogeneity to groups when we're talking about minorities, when we're talking about women, when we're talking about older people, and so on. And so it shows how it enables us to think, actually, what is it that makes people similar, makes people belong to the same group? There are rich and poor, there are elite and non-elite among these groups, and they may feel little in connection with each other. And third analytical payoff is that it reinforces the way that processes of disadvantage and advantage are not deterministic. That very diversity means that things like your family background cannot be seen as determining your outcomes. Even though we often tend to, if we're looking at looking kind of a, the average, looking the general, we often think of these factors as being deterministic. But you can see that actually family background only explains a small part of the diversity of experiences across people, across groups. And I think that point about the issues of these factors not being deterministic also will, I hope, link to what Sonia later says about policy solutions. I'm doing the less practical part. She's going to do the more practical part. But briefly, before I go to that, I want to just also talk about social advantage and disadvantage in terms in relation to having a three-part framework for analysis of the world around us and providing us with a three-part framework. So the three-part framework looking at the processes by which advantage is maintained or disadvantage is maintained. And here I want to highlight the cumulative processes that occur through advantage within domains. So you can think of cumulative accumulation of wealth across generations, across life courses, but also cumulative advantage across domains, across, for example, education, neighbourhood, nation, as well as things like income and occupation. The book itself, as you've seen, has tended to separate out domains and processes and groups, but I think it's instructive to identify how they're interlinked and bring them together again in an analytical framework. Then there's intersectional processes. I think thinking about the multidimensional nature of social disadvantage, which the book, I hope, draws attention to, thinking about distributions and groups as well, leads to consideration of how advantage or disadvantage may be realised in particular ways at the intersections of particular domains of life. So at the intersections of neighbourhood, of family background, of nation, of women for men differently, for minorities and the majority, for older and younger people. And finally, the framework draws attention to thinking about relational processes. So social advantage and disadvantage are summarising relational processes, whereby advantage and disadvantage is created and experienced not simply in an abstract relative way. We often think about relative advantage and disadvantage. If this, we have some concept of the notional richer person and the notional poorer person, but actually it occurs in our day-to-day interactions, in who we talk to, in who we work with, in who we meet, and who we live with. We don't compare ourselves to those people really who have no social relations with. And those are the point at which we judge ourselves to be disadvantaged or advantaged, and in which we create disadvantage and advantage of others. So that's what it gives you. I think you can all go away and use that framework, but I'm going to now hand over to Sonia to talk about maybe what it means a bit more in practice.
Thank you.
Okay, hi. So, yes, my name is Sonia, and I was responsible for writing the education and learning chapter in the book. So I've been asked to say a few words today about how the process of being involved in writing the book has informed my own specific thinking on education. And in particular, I've been asked to reflect on the three-part framework, these three sets of processes. That is the framework for analysis that emerges from the book, and how that specifically informed my thinking on education policy. So with that in mind, the first thing I want to say about writing the chapter in the book is that from the outset, I think it definitely pushed me, most helpfully actually, into thinking much more extensively and much more deeply about what I mean when I say advantage in education. I've focused more on disadvantage in the past in my life, probably. I think education researchers are probably very often engaged in focusing very deeply on what's missing in certain parts of children's lives in education. So missing a positive home learning environment, for example, or the financial resources that families would need in order to be able to afford that environment. arguably, we could say that comparatively less attention has been paid in research historically to the multitude of different ways that parents in more affluent families are always at the same time, to a greater or lesser degree, investing to ensure that they maintain some sense of social distance in education terms for their own children. And so these processes of maintaining positional advantage for their own children specifically. And I think that this book is doing a lot to shine more light on the practices of social advantage, for me certainly in education, and I think that's hugely important. Because what these practices do very much is that they make up part of this notion of cumulative advantage in education. They are part of the cumulative advantage that we see accruing to certain families. So in education, when we think about that kind of accumulation of advantage, you could think about things like intergenerational transfers of cultural capital, valued forms of knowledge that parents are passing on to their children that will help them succeed in education. Also, there's the simple conversion between generations of cold hard cash, of money. Parents paying money to spend on private schools for their children, on private tutoring, on houses that are near the best of the state schools, and so on. So I think that it's important to shine a light on those processes. In policy terms, I think it's probably fair to say that education policy over time in many countries has made some important inroads, at least this is my view. It has made some important inroads into trying to recognise and to challenge cumulative disadvantage in education. There have been, for example, I've talked about this, and also Kitty Stewart has in her chapter, some major extensions in the provision of early years education, which is known to be particularly beneficial for disadvantaged groups. At the same time, though, at the other end of the scale, it can be often considered quite, I think, problematic, practically, but also morally, to think about how we would ever conceivably place limits on the accumulation of educational advantage in education, when ultimately you're talking about parents investing in their children's minds, you're talking about investing in your children's education. How can we place limits on that and say that's a bad thing? And some people here, they might talk about the possibilities of, for example, banning private schools. Some might advocate that as a policy. Others might say, well, that's actually never going to be politically feasible. And even if it was, even if societies did this, it wouldn't be effective because you can ban private schools, but parents will always find other ways to differentially and make sure that they're investing as much as they can in their own children. At the same time, though, I think I would also want to highlight that these discussions where we find ourselves asking about parents' practices, so what can we do about what parents do, I think these clearly also link to much bigger questions for government policy, such as what can we do about the fact that we live in societies which more generally have such unequal rewards that parents are feeling this kind of high-stakes competitive pressure in the first place. So there are much bigger questions about what parents are responding to, I think. Secondly, on this issue of intersectionality, which Lucinda was talking about, a number of important discussions, I think, have been had in the book about the ways that, particularly belonging to a certain group in society, it doesn't ever fully determine our outcomes in life. So people have got multiple identities all going on at once. They live in complicated circumstances. They have varied experiences. And sometimes this means that people have more agency than we might expect in circumstances of disadvantage. And this got me, I think, applying it to what I would think about policy implications. It got me thinking generally about agency in education. What can schools do? What mechanisms can we identify that might maximally help to produce the sorts of conditions where socially disadvantaged groups can have their agency maximised? So in my chapter, I've made quite a lot of probably quite cynical comments about the limits of what schools can do, the way that schools, as formal institutions in capitalist societies, are in many ways constrained in the difference that they can make. They are a product of unequal societies. Often they can be thought of as contributing, as well as challenging, contributing to processes of disadvantage. So, for example, stereotyping and excluding disadvantaged children. But at the same time, I've also pointed in the chapter to efforts on the part of schools and governments inside capitalist states that have made some difference. We do see some difference being made as well. So, for example, general trends towards compensatory spending, higher levels of targeted spending on a range of different types of support and facilities for disadvantaged groups. Many of those have been shown in evidence to directly boost the educational attainment of disadvantaged groups. And thinking about possibilities, maybe we can also go beyond that and think about other ways that schools can make a difference more than they do now. That got me to thinking just generally about if we had greater equalities training in schools, for example, greater training for teachers and for students, a stronger emphasis on the, in the curriculum on issues about equality and justice and inclusion. Arguably, that could make major differences inside schools, the life experiences of students who may be facing discrimination in different forms every day inside schools. And just lastly, just building on the third one there. So this idea that I've talked about of equalities training and trying to build tolerance and respect for different groups inside schools. So the last part of the three-part framework that Lucinda mentioned is about how disadvantage is something that people always experience relationally. And that got me thinking, probably more than anything else, about patterns of segregation in education. Probably my biggest bugbear in my career is this notion of segregation in education. And what I consider to be an overwhelming policy need to challenge this segregation in education, to equalise schools and have a better social balance mix of students who are in those schools. Because if both socially advantaged and socially disadvantaged students only go to schools that primarily educate children who are like them, more than anything else, they're like them, then how many opportunities can they really have to gain understanding of and tolerance of and respect for different social groups? What opportunities do they have to witness the norms of other social groups if they don't ever see them? And if we can't have that in early years of people's life, social mixing in schools, then I think it creates problems for challenging on a bigger level, politically, wider societal capacities to deal with social disadvantage. So that's all.
Okay. Thank you very much. I've assumed that those from LSE are partially, at least, known to the audience. But Fran Bennett, it's a little while since she was at LSE, and since then she's done all sorts of things. She's been director of CPAG. She's now at Oxford, where she's senior research and teaching fellow in the Department of Social Administration, or in intervention and RCTs, or social policy and intervention. I was getting close. She has, for a long time, and still writes and speaks with clarity, charity, and a lot of courage. She's going to discuss the whole book and raise questions for all the authors. And do you want to come here, or do you want to stay there?
No, I think I might not be able to see over the television.
All right.
Yeah. I might have to stay here. Okay. Thank you so much, David, and thank you, everybody, for inviting me. I wanted to pay tribute to the LSE authors first, both Centre for Analysis of Social Exclusion and also the wider group of LSE authors here. The connections that I've got with particularly the case authors span many years, as David has just kindly not said in terms of how many, but he did try to teach me economics about 40 years ago. I'm not quite sure very successfully, but anyway, as part of the Diploma in Social Administration that I did do in this university. Two decades later, approximately, I worked with John on the Joseph Rowntree Foundation inquiry, into income and wealth. And I also have worked quite a lot with Tanya over many years at the Journal of Poverty and Social Justice. And more recently, been very pleased to welcome Isabel Schutz as a research associate in the department at Oxford before she came here. So I've got many links with the authors. So I know from personal experience that the kind of thing that the case authors write is not just the kind of go-to literature, but the authors of that literature are also the kind of people who share issues of common concern and who are colleagues that one wants to collaborate with. So I wanted to say that to begin with, because this gives me the opportunity to do that, which I don't have very often. I wanted to pick up, first of all, on two preliminary things in what the authors say about the book, one of which David's referred to, not so much the other. So the one he referred to was that it's a sort of replacement, which is what the authors say, really, a sort of replacement for Understanding Social Exclusion, which was written in 2002 and which I refer to a lot. And I think it's interesting because it does pick up on some of the issues which were prominent in that book and in the understanding of social exclusion that a lot of us, I think, have, which is about relativity. So being socially excluded, you have to be socially excluded from a particular society. It's not an absolute. It's a relative thing. About agency. So social exclusion means who is doing the excluding. Is it you or is it somebody else? And of course, processes. So social exclusion is usually about not having prospects as well as about what's happening to you at the moment. And I think all those are incorporated in the kind of insights that there are in this book. I think the key difference is probably that there's more focus in this book, as David and others have said, on the other end of the spectrum. In other words, cumulative advantage. And I think that's something that all of us should have been doing more. And I think it's fantastic that this book does that. I've just been involved in writing a report about poverty with a group of another eight women as a response to a challenge from Bob Holman, who's the community activist from Easter House, who posed a challenge about writing about poverty today. And we did that and we launched the report and so on. His other challenge in the same Guardian article was that we ought to go away and investigate the rich. And actually, we haven't yet done that, and I feel rather guilty to Bob for not having done that. So I think it's really good that that is what this book does. I think it's still perhaps somewhat unevenly addressed in different chapters. I'm meant to be doing comments as well as just praising the book. So I think it's somewhat unevenly addressed in different chapters. I think there are still challenges there. And I think Tim Newbern actually generously says that in his chapter, that it's rather difficult to do that in the area of crime. And I think there are different challenges in different areas, as is also said in the book. I think particularly Tanya and Rod do this in their chapter. So talking about advantage being higher achievement in the same kind of context, in the same kind of area, if you like. Talking about people being able to achieve combinations which are not available to people who are disadvantaged. And talking about people being able to have things which are wholly unavailable to those people who are disadvantaged. So all those are quite a tricky bag of tricks, if you like, to look at each area of the book. So I think you should be applauded by all of us for actually having a go, and also for arguing that the advantage and disadvantage spheres are inextricably bound together, which I think is quite right. The second thing that the authors say about the book is that it originated in an MSc taught course in the department, and it's aimed at postgraduates. It is, in my experience, a very useful discipline for writing clearly to be based on a course and for the coherence of the conception as something that you're talking about. So I think that's very apparent in this book. For example, in the explanation of Bourdieu, where I learnt quite a lot, and in the exposition of Sen's ideas. I had a student once who said, Sen is so cool. So that was great as well. And also in the different definitions of wealth in John's chapter, which I think is really useful and which people often don't grasp, and so they get very muddled about what we're talking about in terms of wealth. So I think that clarity is very and coherence of conception is very good about the book. But of course, it will be valuable to a much wider group of people than just students. And the tripartite structure, I think, is particularly useful for that. So concepts, as has been said, concepts and theories across the life course, cross-cutting themes, and then, of course, the conclusion. So I wanted to reflect on the overall theme a bit, talk about issues raised in the book that interest me in particular, areas where I think it makes a particular contribution, and where it could go further or in a slightly different direction. So the overall theme, actually this has been talked about already, so I won't say very much. It's basically, it's either, is it comprehensive or is it catch-all? In other words, is it comprehensive and therefore useful, or is it catch-all and therefore kind of confusing and not exact? I think the cumulative processes, intersectionality, and relational processes that are picked out and that Lucinda talked about mean that it's the latter. So I think, means it's the former. So I think it's comprehensive and not just a rag bag, if you like. Sorry about that. Luckily, I caught it fairly quickly. And I think the forensic discussion in the different areas also means that. Social exclusion, on the other hand, was a very slippery concept, I think. And social justice is becoming so these days as well. I think those are very, they're a bit like Humpty Dumpty. You know, a word can mean whatever I want it to mean. And I think, though, that social advantage and disadvantage may not have that same problem. I think it's broad enough for it not to have that same problem, in a sense. And I think also the advantage, if you like, of social advantage and disadvantage is that the framing picks up on the recent interest in inequality and can incorporate that, whereas I think social exclusion and nowadays social justice may not be able to do that. Although social exclusion did talk about the self-exclusion of the rich, of course, if you read it properly, I think. And I think the interest in inequality these days, it's important, and this book will help to explore the relationship between inequality and poverty, which LSE is doing, for example, for Oxfam, and it's also doing some work for the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. And I think the interesting thing there is Michael Marmot's key insight, which is the stratification going all the way up, rather than it just being about the poor and the rich. Now, this book prompted me to go back and reread a book called Disadvantage by Avner de Chalet and Joe Wolfe, which is referenced in this publication. They didn't talk as much about advantage. It's only called Disadvantage, their book, although I think for them, functionings actually featured as advantages and fulfilled some of the same role. I'll talk a bit more about the book later on because I think it's quite interesting. But at the moment, it's just to note that they don't really do numbers. so that actually, although theirs is a very useful book, I think, it doesn't have the comprehensive coverage that this book does. So issues that came up from me reading the book that interest me in particular, one is the unit of analysis, and I know John will say I always talk about this, but the unit of analysis I think is really quite difficult. So you've got equalities and human rights, which are very much an individual focus, and then you've got poverty and in income distribution and wealth, which is often a household focus. And I think it's really hard for us. I was going to say this later, but I'll say it now, actually. I've been trying to struggle with Mary Daly. Not struggle with Mary Daly. Struggle. Mary Daly and I have been trying to struggle with trying to talk about gender and poverty. And actually, it's really difficult because gender inequality tends to be looked at as women and men. Actually, I think it should be a process thing, just like social advantage and disadvantage. But it tends to be measured as women and men. And actually, poverty tends to be measured as household. And it's actually conceptually really difficult to marry those two together, so to speak, and to talk about them. So I think the unit is a really tricky idea in here. Our analysis of the reasons for low income... whilst we measure in households, our analysis for the reasons for low income, if you look at households below average income, for example, are actually in the benefit unit and the family, the nuclear family, not the household. So it's really tricky, I think. The other thing that struck me is the idea about those in institutions are not hard to reach at all. Actually, they're very easy to reach, but we don't actually measure them very much. And similarly, with the ones right at the top of society, we don't really measure them very much either. So the ones right at the bottom and the ones right at the top, we tend not to have as much information about as we do the ones in between. The other thing that struck me as an area of interest was the fungibility, if you like, of areas of disadvantage. And that's particularly important in the Sustainable Livelihoods Framework. There wasn't that much in terms of the discipline of international development in the book. And I think sometimes it's quite useful. And the assets framework in the Sustainable Livelihoods Framework, I think, is really helpful. I can never remember it, so somebody here probably does. But there are five different kinds of assets. But one of the questions which is asked about is, how fungible is one area of assets with the other? So, for example, when it was applied to Scotland, one of the findings was that lone parents in particular, when they went into employment, were then not able to do the reciprocal social networks, which was about caring for each other's children because they were at work. And so their social networking and that reciprocation actually went down, just as their employment and income, if you like, went up because they got a job. So it's that kind of, either can you substitute one for the other, or does an advantage in one actually mean, therefore, a disadvantage in the other? And I think that could be talked about a bit more. The other thing is, do we value one area more than another? One of the things in the gender work I've been doing recently, which really, really struck me, was that some of the work in Sweden finds out that women in partnerships would rather be autonomous than actually have a higher living standard by sharing the living standard of their partner. So they prefer to live on a lower independent income than they do to be dependent on their male partner and share his living standard. And I just think that's really quite tricky. So they value autonomy so highly that actually they value it more than a higher living standard with dependency on their partner. And it's those kind of, you know, reason to value is what Sen says. And in the book that's interpreted as things like you shouldn't value murder. But actually, reason to value, if you think about that subjectively at all, then it brings up those tricky kinds of issues, I think. The areas where I think the book makes a particular contribution... Do you want me to stop soon? Or
no.
Am I all right? I've already commented on the overall contribution, so I won't go back to that. But I wanted to look at some of the topical or less usual issues that the book covers. Particularly, I think, migration and citizenship, Isabel's chapter, which is really interesting in terms of things like, are benefit claimants failed citizens? Well, they certainly are when they're looked at as migrants. How gender plays out within the area of migration and citizenship, issues like that. I thought the having a chapter on space was very interesting, the importance of geography. And it looked in particular at cities and neighbourhoods, and obviously that's particularly topical because of devolution. So, for example, Ruth Lupton is working in Manchester on inclusive growth at the moment, another ex-LSE person. I think that's really interesting because it will mean that there may be opportunities in devolved areas to do things about social advantage and disadvantage that we're not necessarily doing at the UK level. And I think also it came up, the spatial issue came up in the migration chapter about transnational ways of redistributing, for example, via remittances and so on. So space is not just citizen neighbourhoods, but actually broader than that as an issue in the book as well. And I think one key issue which was brought up but not explored that much, I thought, is place more important for some groups than it is for others? And John knows because I've quoted this before, but the things about some things being within a pushchair's distance of your home is really important for those with young children, for example. So I think is place more important for some than others is really interesting as well. I like the idea in Stephen's chapter about looking at twice median income, in other words, looking at not just the top 1% and not just those in poverty, but actually let's have a look and see what's happening there more towards the middle. Well, twice median. and the religion chapter, I thought was really interesting. Malcolm's chapter, it was more discursive than some of the others, and it talks about, I mean, one of the interesting things I thought was it talked about religion freeing people from the tyranny of choice in some ways. And I just think that's quite an interesting idea. And also the idea that religion might compensate for some people for disadvantages in other areas. So it's this fungibility a bit that I was talking about before. And it might give them comfort. It might give them society. It might give them status. Although I'm not sure that he really explored sufficiently about this thing about it giving them authority within religion. because, of course, the position of authority within religion for some people is not necessarily the same for everybody within that religion, and you might think particularly of gender issues there, and for those with less power in the group. So lastly, areas where I think the book could go further or in a different direction. Now, the authors already acknowledge some of these. They talk about disability not being covered hugely. They talk about politics and power. They talk about historical things, and they talk about multicultural or group rights. So I'm kind of leaving those aside. I thought the life course, there could be more in that, perhaps. I mean, childhood and family was covered in her usual fantastic way by Kitty. But whilst paid work was seen as part of the life course, there wasn't actually a caring chapter as part of the life course. Now, parenting was dealt with, but particularly in relation to early childhood, and to some extent in Sonia's as well. But and obviously there was an ageing chapter, which also brings up issues of care. But I just wondered whether it should be given the status of something that people have at various stages in their life course, just like work is, paid work. In terms of the going back really to the De Chalet and Wolf book, Wolf and De Chalet book, I thought there might be room for more on the nuances of what the conclusion calls cumulative advantage and disadvantage processes, intersectionality and relational processes. For example, Wolf and De Chalet raise the idea of corrosive disadvantage. What is a corrosive disadvantage? And against my advice, they also talk about fertile functionings. I told them they had to find a different word for that, but they didn't. Anyway, what they mean is that this is more than just waiting, and it's more than just whether those affect the same people rather than different people, but it's whether some disadvantages and some advantages, not necessarily the same ones, are particularly important because they lead to others, or they have exponential power or potential, if you like, as particular forms of disadvantage. So that was one thing I thought was quite useful in their book, which could be maybe incorporated more. Another one was their highlighting of insecurity and the vulnerability to risk actually being a significant disadvantage in its own right, even if that disadvantage never happens. And I thought that was really important, and it's something Michael Orton has written about, in particular for Compass recently, in his writing on security. And in terms of intersectionality, I thought it's not just who's got what combination of characteristics, because it can start sounding a bit like a list, but it's the relationship between one and the other, so gender inequality and poverty, as I was talking about before, that we've been struggling with. So the importance of the book, I think, is about the shape, it's about the shape, it's about the drivers, and it's about the implications of social advantage as well as disadvantage, and that's hugely important. I think we can end up thinking it's all too much, so it includes the idea of power over others given by the advantages that people have, and it includes a lot about the intergenerational transmission of advantages, which is so important now and which can lead us all to think that it's all completely hopeless. But the joy of something written by people from CASE and the wider LSE community is partly that you do get the concepts and the theories, partly that you do get the data and the number crunching, but also that you also get the policy ideas, just as Sonia has shown us just now, about what to do about all that as well. So when the authors say the boundaries are not immutable of advantage and disadvantages, and cumulative advantage is not irreversible, I try and believe them. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. We're now just going to have a move people round, and following David Donison's late wife, who used to got allowed people to get up and wave their arms around halfway through meetings because it... refresh them. Feel free to do that. And I'm just going to make a quick announcement that I've been asked to. All right.
Yeah. Think where to go, otherwise you'll just tell you there's a change of venue.
Well, I know where it is.
Well,
John Hills could make it much better than I could. But the Institute for International Inequality is having a conference next Wednesday. Some of you will already have signed up for that, but it is moved in order to retain good relations with the UCU. To Friends Meeting House on Euston Road, a very appropriate location. But that, not because it's owned by Quakers, but I think for other reasons the drinks party is cancelled. But anyway, it's moved there, but they're going to discuss their annual report and their research agenda, but there are more tickets available if anyone's interested in that. It's a very important meeting because it's the first big meeting of the Institute for International Inequality, which has just started under John Hills and Mike Savage's directorship. But that's all I know.
Should I just say, I mean, a bit more exciting than discussing our annual report, which we won't mention. It's got all-star speakers, including Kimberly Crenshaw, David Sassafage, Thomas Piketty, and Stephen Jenkins. And various others, a lot going on. And that event, we will be releasing some more tickets. If you're already booked, you'll be getting information about how to get to Friends House. Will be during the day. There will be another event back here in the evening. But as a result of being a bigger venue, we're releasing more tickets. So if you haven't booked yet, please look at the Inequalities Institute website. And I think at some point tomorrow, those extra tickets will be released if they haven't been already. The first 100 people, on top of people already booked, will get lunch. After that, I'm afraid people will have to fend for themselves or appeal for redistribution from the...
Okay, thank you very much. Now we'll get that Fran's discussion was very helpful. We had a discussion of themes, of issues of interest, of particular contributions, areas to go further, and people may wish to organise their responses to that. But Stephen Jenkins, Coretta Phillips, Isabel Schutz, all from LSE, so they're not going to get a great introduction from me. But have 5 minutes. I don't know if you have collectively decided who has the advantage or disadvantage of starting. Should we go in the order that they're listed here? Stephen.
Right. I'd like to thank Fran very much for her perceptive comments. It's amazing to take all that stuff in and to benefit from her views on so much. Given that she said so much and there's so little I disagree with, I'm going to take the opportunity to say one thing, really, and which is very closely related to the theme of this book. As you know, I work on income inequality, so which is a very traditional approach to this topic. And if you read many newspapers and otherwise, you'll often hear people on the one hand saying, income inequality has not gone up since the 1990s. There are also people on the other side who say income inequality has gone up massively. How can that exist? And the answer is to do with the different data sources that people are referring to. And as sort of a bit of an advertisement for next week as well, I just want to make it very clear, and it comes out in the book as well, that you know, a lot of the action that's going on in Britain's income distribution really is at the top, at the very, very top. And that, by the way, top includes LSE professors, just in case you get anything wrong. No, people forget, so it's very important to know precisely who is up there. And so if we take any account of both the survey data that is responsible for the position about saying inequality hasn't gone up over this period, if you take into account tax data and put the two things together, it's very, very clear that inequality is going up and it's being driven at the top. And I think that's a very important point to take away, not to lose. And interesting, it's just to one reflection for Fran, is that looking at proportion of people who've got an income above twice the median, in fact, that's pretty much stayed the same over the last 20 years. It's actually the rise in the number of people with half a million or a million or whatever that is going up. So the point is, it's, you know, the fractionalisation is really at the top. And you can read the book and see what we say about that in terms of the things that Lucinda mentioned about the processes, the knock-on effects of those sorts of things. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Coretta.
Thank you. So I think what I'd like to focus on is, as a researcher in a sense, is some of the methodological challenges that this book poses, because it seems to me that there are quite a number of potentially quite contradictory elements of the research process that we need to take into account when we're thinking about some of these issues across different groups. So just to start, I think there was discussion about the importance of understanding within group diversity, and my chapter with Lucinda is looking at that in the context of minority ethnic groups. And one of the challenges, I think, is to both be able to talk about advantage and disadvantage and the importance of doing that for enhancing and moving away from some of the more deterministic discussions about race, so that people are positioned essentially on the basis of their racial or ethnic identity, and that sets the tone for the rest of their lives. And I think it's very clear, although I'm not sure that either the quantitative or the qualitative research has really been able to dig into this in enough detail, that people will experience across those different ethnic groups both advantage and disadvantage within the same individual across the life cycle, and also within groups. And I don't think we've really got to grips with how that plays out across the most of the main minority ethnic groups. So one way forward might be to think more in terms of longitudinal research, so where we have the quantitative measures of where we can look at outcomes. But also, I think probably what's part of the picture is some qualitative research which looks at perhaps life history approaches, in which we understand the context of people's lives in its entirety and the way in which people understand their life experiences. And I think that is one way in which we can try and understand a bit more about agency, because certainly in the race field, there has been very much a tendency to think in terms of particular groups being positioned in very exclusive ways and not being able to take account of that, of what's often kind of multiplicity of experiences. I think the other thing that's also something that we need to take account of, and is also quite difficult to do within the sort of quantitative qualitative divide, is to think about the way in which some groups may experience both advantage but also discrimination and racism. So it may be the case that groups can be compared across ethnicity or racial, whichever kind of categories that you want to use, but that also recognise that that may still mean that those groups, even though they might be deemed advantaged, still are vulnerable to processes of discrimination and racism. And that's really very obvious in certainly in the educational field, but also in the employment context. And then I think the last point I'd like to make is about the cumulative effects. And so far we've talked very much about the cumulative effects of, in particular, childhood experiences, education, and then participation in the labour market. But the part which is always puzzling to me, given that I'm a criminologist, is that we tend not to talk about people's experiences of crime, security, insecurity, and risk. And that, of course, has the same kind of contours in terms of experience, both victimisation and criminality, that we talk about in relation to poverty and income inequality. And so if there are any of you out there who are looking for PhD topics, rather than doing what I've spent my career doing, hanging out on housing estates, being stuck in police custody areas and being in prison but being able to obviously get out at the end of the day, actually I'm sure there's quite a lot of work that can be done at golf clubs and a whole range of other kinds of, I'm not even sure what the term is because I'm not familiar enough with them, but golf clubs and the like. I'll end there, I think.
Thank you very much. Isabel.
Just to pick up on Fran's comments and others' comments around relational processes, I suppose What I've reflected on in being involved in the book is the extent to which, while we all recognise the importance of thinking about relational processes in relation to our understanding of advantage and disadvantage, we still tend to operate in a way in which we sort of have the sort of siloed approach to understanding or to naming different groups. So when we think about, as I reflected on in writing the chapter on migration, when we talk about migrants, how we operate with particular assumptions about who are migrants, and often we see migrants as being disadvantaged, whereas, as Lucinda pointed out, there are some who are extremely advantaged. And what that actually means in terms of how we reflect on those processes in our work and how we try to make connections between different groups in understanding that there is diversity and inequalities not only between different groups but among different groups. And I suppose in thinking about those relational processes, how we extend that beyond looking at the relationship between different groups and also the relationship between different, for want of a better word, different dimensions in people's lives. So Fran commented on the extent to which care is perhaps not given as much attention as work in the book. And I suppose in carrying out qualitative research, these sorts of issues really come to light in that, you know, well, as researchers, we sort of think about, okay, well, I want to look at people's experiences of disadvantage in relation to work. When you're carrying out qualitative research and interviewing people about their lives, you can't not look at the dynamic interactions between work and care and how the two have huge, are hugely interrelated in terms of people's everyday life experiences. So I suppose in reflecting on all these issues with respect to migration, which is the area in which I've written about it in the book, I think going forward it's hugely important for those of us interested in migration and issues of advantage and disadvantage to try to take migration out of this sort of, if you like, narrow camp in which we're focusing on migrants, and to think about the ways in which mobility and migration is something that has implications for all of us and how it shapes processes of advantage and disadvantage for those who are highly mobile in terms of movements across countries, those who are very mobile with respect to their experiences in the labour market. I suppose broadening our understanding of migration to encompass a more relational approach to understanding mobilities.
Okay, well, thank you very much indeed, Isabel and Coretta and Stephen, for those responses. It's now very much open for questions or reasonably short comments to discuss what's been said, elucidated if that's needed. It's open to anyone. There's microphones going round, which is not because it's an enormous room, but because a podcast is maybe made of this. I have to say may, because sometimes all the technical reasons it doesn't happen, but it may be. So if you could wait for a microphone and put your hands up, and we may take them in threes, but that's, I've noticed a way in which politicians evade answering any of the questions. They're quite good at it anyway, but we start over there.
David Walker, I write for The Guardian Public. An obvious question to ask, because of where you are in the academic world, is impact. What kind of impact do you think this kind of analysis, the focuses you've described to us this evening, will have in present policy context? Not just a question of having policy ideas, looking at the potential application of this analysis to the likely opportunities for policy change. And I say that with a slightly heavy heart, A, because I know how normatively committed many of you are to the subjects of your inquiry, but B, a slight degree of pessimism if you look back at the history of social science investigation of poverty and disadvantage over, let's say, the last half century, not at all clear that there are points of direct impact on policy or indeed public understanding.
Okay, can we talk about that, because I think it's very important issue. We'll come to the others, but whether the editors or do you want to join us on the up here, or you can speak from where you are. All right. But go ahead, Hart. Oh yes.
I have a website. I thought you were collecting questions, David.
No, I'm not.
No. Okay, David, my response to you is in one word. It's called advantage. And particularly in the current government's context, I think it's particularly important to get two things out. One is the facts about the nature of advantage, and the fact that thinking about distributions or how well off people are is not just about the poor. It's also associated with the rich, and there is the factual issues about what actually counts as advantage. And I think there is a lot of people need to get real about what counts as advantage. And you and me are actually advantage. A lot of people think that they are not advantage, and that's important in terms of actually getting things done compared to the others, who are just the small people at the bottom. And related to that is given straightening out the facts, is to actually start thinking about processes. Even if we don't, we think like Tony Blair that it's okay, we're comfortable about David Beckham doing very well regardless of what's going on. It's fine, but I think we actually need to start with the facts before going on to the thinking about what the implications are of those the processes, and what the knock-on effects are of this advantage at the top. And that would be a huge change. We've moved from the Thatcher era that Hartley alluded to before, when the P word was abolished, and we've been through lots of difficulties then. But I think the A word is particularly important now.
A great trust in facts.
I'm going to answer in a race-specific way, and probably quite pessimistically, because of course we can think in terms of advantage, and the usual example is to think about the fact that we have mixed race African American president. So how can it be that there are all of these problems in relation to ethnic and racial inequality? And so whilst I would and have talked about the importance of advantage, I think we need to be really careful about the implications of that, as acting in a sense as a kind of mask for significant inequality and disadvantage. And then the second point that I'd like to make as well, I think, is that we've tended perhaps not to think too carefully in recent times about the public and what public attitudes may be. So this audience, I would imagine, to a degree, we're probably preaching to the converted, and that it seems to me that we don't actually have a good sense of, in relation to racial inequality, what's considered acceptable. So does it matter, for example, that there are those of traveller and gypsy origin who have the most bleak socioeconomic outcomes? Not a focus, not something that we certainly talk about either in the book. Does it matter when we might also see white, Jewish, men, and perhaps to a degree Indian men of Hindu origin being advantaged? We certainly wouldn't want to argue that those categories mean that they're unlikely to experience racism or discrimination, which was the point that I made before. But actually, we know that generally speaking, the public are not very much in favour of any kind of ameliorative measures which are trying to focus on equality of outcome. So there is actually, I think, a conversation about what degree of inequality are the publics prepared to put up with, I guess. So an assumption that it's about increasing the advantage of disadvantaged groups is something that we're taking perhaps as a given. I'm not sure that there is very strong evidence for that.
Okay, any last point on public impact? Did you want to say something?
Very briefly. Yes, I'd kind of sort of pick up on the one hand. I mean, you know, Fran has been indicating the, you know, the limitations. So you haven't gone far enough, which, you know, was something that, you know, clearly we acknowledged. And I think it is a question in terms of impact, of saying, where does this take us? What is the, if you like, the paradigm shift that we might be able to foist, both within the academy, amongst policymakers. And, for example, because this was very much prepared as a teaching text amongst our students, and obviously the students that we have in this institution often go on into important roles elsewhere. And the real challenge, I think, and in terms of those points at which we did not go far enough in this book, because we were just beginning, I think, to set an agenda, and we didn't necessarily know how far this could be taken, was the point made by Isabel about the whole point about silo approaches, as us continuing as academics to work within silos in terms of the groups with whom we specialise, the life course stages on which we focus, the topics, the concepts that with which we are most familiar, and the necessity for the sheer hard work of beginning to actually work across those boundaries, which is hard work. It's like interdisciplinary academic work. It's something we don't necessarily get on with, having said it's important that we do this. So I think, if you'd like, I'd like to see the impact of the book as being something of a general sort of challenge to begin to do some of that, you know, hard work. We did our best, as it were. Yeah. We had an author's workshop and we discussed these things, but we still didn't get there, and you know, it's what, where we go next.
Okay, there was a question. Somebody else in the middle there? The gentleman.
No, the woman in the middle, with dark hair.
Oh, sorry, I beg your pardon. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Gudish. I'm a consultant for the OECD. So my question might be quite obvious, but I wondered, listening to everyone touching on different themes like immigration, race, gender, religion, if one or the other kind of shaped an individual's advantage or disadvantage more, if that made sense.
Immigration, race, and...
Yeah, it was just some of the themes that was touched on. When,
which was...
Yeah, I mean, there was a content slide that kind of looked at all the other themes that were discussed. I wondered if... And parents or family background, if one or the other actually shaped someone's advantage or disadvantage more than the other.
Okay, excuse me, your question, was that anything to do with that? No? No, let's just talk about that for a minute. Who would like to talk about that? Which was more important? Presumably everyone
too
thinks
hard,
things
too hard.
That things
really
that
hard.
Our own chapter.
Yes.
Lucinda.
Do you want to say?
No.
I was going to say, I think it's a really good question, but it's also a really hard question, because I think what, I mean, partly it's a kind of manageability thing, so we kind of break things down, and then we didn't really look across, okay, so how do these weigh out? And I think there's a lot, I think some of the chapters have that implicit in them, so to what extent is racial disadvantage implicated in income disadvantage and the cumulative processes of marginalisation that then play out in subsequent lives, which links kind of to the parenting chapter. But I think it's a very good question. I think it's really important that we do try and go further about those, about thinking about how processes unfold and which bits are salient at different points. I think that, but that will depend a lot on context, depend on where people are living at a particular time, who they're surrounded by, and it's a big project.
I'll put my head on the block and say that, though I said it in jest, I'll say the family, partly because the family actually incorporates many of the other things that you mentioned. When you're born, you're born to a parent from a particular ethnic background with particular level of resources through childhood, potential family structure. That has, as Sonia documents, very has strong effects on education, and that has knock-on effects. Mm. So, you know, the beginning is really important. I mean, this is why people like James Heckman, Nobel Prize winner, economist, is now changed his whole career from being a you know, nose down econometrician into looking at the cumulative life course consequences of stuff. And I think that's brought together in Kitty's chapter, but many of those other things actually come in within the family context, broadly interpreted. Mm.
Yeah, no, that's loud. I was just going to say, that I think it's really difficult as well because the nature of what we're looking at, social advantage and disadvantage, has so many different aspects to it that the different bits that there will be, it's very hard to quantify impact and size of impact and size of different factors relative to each other sometimes. But even where you can, it will vary what is the strongest impact, what is the biggest thing, depending on what you're trying to impact on what. So, and those things are different, you know, because when you unpack the different bits of social disadvantage and advantage, but also, I mean, it varies across space and time so much as well. Different countries would have different, stronger impact of gender, for example, and so on. So, so I think it's very difficult to answer, basically. Right.
I was just going to say this is like the corrosive disadvantage and fertile functionings, really. Yeah. And the answer that I think Wolf and DeShalit gave was what they call affiliation, which is another rather peculiar word, but they mean social relationships. So I was quite interested and surprised that they said that. And they don't do number crunching at all, as I say. They go around and chat to people. And from their chats with people, which they call consultation, well, they call it a really long phrase, but I can't remember what that is, something academic equilibrium or something. Anyway, they go around and chat to people, and they come up with the idea that affiliation is really, really important for people's health, for people's welfare, for people's happiness, for people's success, for people, da, 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 da. So that's kind of, I suppose you would argue, social network, social capital, all that kind of thing.
Okay.
That was one example.
Right. I know it's very complex, but each of us in our brains has 100,000 billion synapses which are trying to do interconnections, so it's tough, but we ought to be able to manage it. The gentleman with the turquoise mobile phone.
Phone a friend.
Duncan Exley, my question doesn't follow on from the last one, but does to some extent to David's one. I'm very wary in policy making that there is often in the political discourse a very effective attempt to dress up quite regressive things as very progressive. Today, for instance, in the Queen's speech, we had the changes to the fair funding formula, which aren't very fair, which will be regressive. And there has been similar work on language to sell regressive changes to inheritance tax, to income tax, all sorts of things. I think I'm probably in a similar place to David when I say that, you know, this book, from what I can see of it, seems to be a very good product for policymakers should they take notice of it. But I'd be interested in whether or not you'd had thoughts, any of you, in writing this book about how to do the correct window dressing for this, and about how language and perceptions of policymakers and public can be gone along with to make this more effectively sold.
Anyone want to reflect on that?
Say something very brief.
So I haven't got a full answer now. I'll have to think about that one. But a very brief answer, I think, has come back partly to something Stephen said earlier, that is, I think we need to be more honest about where we are in the spectrum and about our complicity in processes of advantage and disadvantage as academics. And I remember being at an inequality conference that was held in a castle on a lake. And we were supposed to be talking about inequality. We were supposed to be talking about the distribution, and everybody was always talking about them. They were talking about the disadvantaged, and they were talking about the others. And I think we're really bad at acknowledging that actually it isn't about them, it's about us. So that would be my starting point, but it's a very small starting point. I think I need to think more about having a more comprehensive answer.
Okay, we're nearly out of time. There's this gentleman at the back, and we're trying to get in the lady at the front. If your question relates to that, can you say so?
Okay, I don't think my question does relate to that. First, I really must thank the one speaker whose name I've forgotten, who mentioned not just golf courses but gypsies. As it happens, my mother was a gypsy woman, and where I come from, that makes me a gypsy. And we have a peculiar experience of these things, and that's, although I spend half my working time in matters relating to exclusion, it's the first time I've heard gypsies mentioned in an academic context unless I mention it, so thank you very much. My question, though, relates to, I think, what Sonia Exley was saying. She was saying that, if I understood correctly, that disadvantage is portrayed as something missing, essentially, and and perhaps that effect is enhanced by the fact that we can't ordinarily consider the possibility, or there are many barriers to taking away advantages from the advantage group, so it sets up a sort of negative perspective of things missing. Do you mean we're overlooking things that excluded groups have that that perhaps could form more of a mechanism to build on in challenging disadvantage, obviously?
You mentioned gypsies.
Yeah, I wasn't. I think probably Sonia, since we haven't got much time.
The question was to Sonia.
Really? Okay, sorry.
I think when I said what I meant about the idea of something being missing, I suppose I was talking about one of the ideas that's been presented very much in the conclusions to the book, that we tend to talk about this idea of them as being, and promote sort of this idea that some sort of deficit culture, that the culture of poverty, they're missing stuff, you know, they don't have what the rest of us, the normal majority, have. And I think that very much needs to be problematized in policy terms. You know, we can provide home learning environments, we can provide resources that enable parents to buy more books, but I think that it is problematic to say that there are deficit cultures within poorer communities, I guess. And I think we need to, generally, I think in education policy, we talk a lot about how we need to give disadvantaged groups more stuff, the implication being they don't have enough already. They don't have enough of what is sort of legitimately valued in society. And so... that's what I meant. I think the policy is always about thinking about what people don't have and we need to give them. And of course, there are certainly resources that need to be sort of redistributed and targeted in certain groups' directions. But I think we don't think about what other people do have and just quite how much they do have rather than don't have. And that's what I meant, really.
Okay. We take one very last question, two rows back from me. But you can, all the authors, editors will be having one or more drinks. So you can ask any questions later. But
I was going to say, you can answer this over wine outside if you want to. I was wondering really whether any of the chapters touched on people who are able to move from a relatively disadvantaged position to an advantaged position, hesitant to use the word social mobility, because you talked about that being a term that possibly is going out of fashion. But whether within each of those chapters and within your topics, whether that was something that was looked at or thought of.
Yes.
I'll read your chapter then, Stephen, thanks.
How?
Chapters 4 and 7.
4 and 7.
So you want a brief question, brief answer. But the problem is that we have difficulties. Again, most of the information we have is about movements in and out near the bottom. And so rather than actually the amount of information that we have about movement at the top, so for example, you know, in traditional stuff, but we have information about persistence and poverty movements in and out, but we know very little. We know nothing about movements in and out of those at the very top. The Inland Revenue Work, the HMRC, do not provide the data.
Okay, well... just outside the door, there's a modest reception. Can I remind you that the book's on sale there, and that Hartley and Lucinda and all the other authors will sign it if you wish. Could I thank all the authors and editors, because it's a huge task putting together about a book like this. Could I thank Maria and Anthony for organising the event, and above all, thank you all for coming this evening.
And our chair.